From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're not mining or trolling through the personal lives of millions of innocent Americans. Our efforts are focused on links to Al-Qaeda and their known affiliates.
President Bush is on the defensive after it's revealed the National Security Agency is secretly collecting the phone call records of millions of Americans, creating the largest database in the world. Telecom companies AT&T, Verizon, Bell South were complicit in the eavesdropping and may be called before Congress. Then the Yes Men strike again, this time speaking as Halliburton representatives telling corporate executives about a new invention, a suit to protect them from global warming.
And they gave us a big challenge. In 2001, they said, we want something that's going to be able to save a human being no matter what Mother Nature throws at them. And so this is the answer. This is the Halliburton Survivor Ball.
And this Sunday is Mother's Day. We'll speak with two mothers who've lost their sons in Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has responded to the latest in the domestic spy scandal with near silence. At the White House, President Bush declined to address Thursday's report that the National Security Agency is creating a database of phone call records with the help of the country's largest telecom companies. The president said only that the spy program is lawful, but did not cite any constitutional or legal authority to back up his claim. At another news conference, CIA director nominee Michael Hayden, who headed the NSA at the time the spy program was implemented, said he would not discuss any specifics. He also canceled many of his meetings with senators yesterday. On Capitol Hill, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter announced he would call officials from the three telecommunications companies, AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South, accused of helping the government spy on U.S. citizens. Congressmember Maurice Hinchey repeated his calls for a full investigation.
This administration has cultivated in our country a culture of fear. And they believe that by cultivating this culture of fear, they can engage in essentially whatever they want to, no matter how viciously it violates the law. And that's exactly what they are doing in this particular NSA program.
New York Congressmember Maurice Hinchey will join us in a few minutes after headlines to discuss the latest in the NSA spy scandal. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says he's confident the standoff over Iran's nuclear activities can be resolved diplomatically. Mohammed El-Baradei spoke in Amsterdam on Thursday.
I am very optimistic. I hope both sides will move away from the war of words. I hope the pitch will go down. I hope people will adopt a cool-headed approach. I hope people will make the necessary compromises. And we need compromises from both sides to ensure, on the one hand, that Iran has the right to use nuclear energy for peaceful purpose, and nobody questioned that right. But at the same time, Iran owe it to the international community to make sure that its program is exclusively for peaceful purpose. So they have work to do with the IAEA to clarify outstanding issues.
IAEA head Mohammed El-Baradei. Meanwhile, on a visit to Lebanon, MIT professor Noam Chomsky was asked about the Bush administration's row with Iran.
Regional superpower Israel is threatening to attack it. The U.S. is threatening to attack it. These threats alone are outright violations of international law, of the U.N. Charter, and Iran is in difficulty. Iran has been trying for some years to negotiate the settlement, but the U.S. just refuses.
Professor Noam Chomsky in Lebanon. In Iraq, four U.S. soldiers were killed earlier today when their tank plunged into a town in a canal in the town of Karma. Their deaths bring to 12 the number of U.S. service members who have lost their lives over the past week. In the Chagos Archipelago of the Indian Ocean, Natives of the island of Diego Garcia have won a long-term battle to return home. British forces expelled the islanders nearly 40 years ago to make way for a U.S. military base. Recent attempts to return were blocked on the grounds the U.S. needed the islands to carry out the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some 2,000 U.S. troops remain on Diego Garcia. Olivier Barcourt, a refugee, was asked when he would return.
We will go as soon as we can.
Does that go for everyone else here?
Yeah, we will go.
We will go.
In Egypt, police staged a massive crackdown Thursday on protests organized in support of two indicted judges that have led to a campaign for judicial independence. Thousands of officers were deployed to block protests outside the courtroom and around Cairo. Scores of people were beaten and detained, including at least 20 journalists. In Nigeria, U.S. oil executive was killed Wednesday in the Niger Delta. His name was Ricky Wigginton, an operations manager with Texas-based Baker Hughes. He was killed after a gunman shot him from a passing motorcycle. Police believe Hughes was deliberately targeted. In Indonesia, the government has announced it will drop corruption charges against the former dictator Suharto. Political figures have called for a full pardon due to his declining health. Suharto rose to power in the mid-60s in a U.S.-backed coup. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed under his reign. He was forced out of power in 1998 and later charged with embezzling more than $600 million. Back in the United States, a group of European lawmakers are in this country as part of their investigation into the CIA's secret prison facilities and renditions of suspects throughout their continent. But after a meeting with the State Department, Carlos Coelho, the delegation's Portuguese chair, said U.S. officials had given very little information.
They remind the European Committee United States of America are binded by international law, so they deny anything like making renditions to foreign countries to torture and so on. They reminded some declarations from Mrs. Rice, admitting perhaps some kind of mistakes can be happened, but it's our duty to provide. If it is true, no other errors can be made, will make in the future.
That was Carlos Coelho of Portugal. The Associated Press is reporting the Pentagon is examining ways to use the military to patrol the United States border with Mexico. Paul McHale, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Security, has asked aides to draw up plans for the deployment of military resources and troops, including the National Guard. The news comes on the heels of a meeting this week between White House political strategist Karl Rove and several Republican lawmakers where the issue was discussed. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill Thursday, lawmakers approved a measure that would allow limited deployments of military personnel to assist border officials. In Kentucky, Republican Governor Ernie Fletcher has been indicted on charges he illegally awarded political supporters with state jobs. Fletcher was charged with conspiracy, official misconduct, and violating laws against political discrimination. And President Bush's approval rating has hit another new low. According to a poll by Harris Interactive, just 29% of Americans believe the president is doing a good job. Another poll tracking views on the president and the outlook for the United States, led by the New York Times, concludes Americans have a bleaker view of the country's direction than at any time in more than two decades. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. USA Today has revealed the National Security Agency is secretly collecting the phone call records of millions of Americans with the help of AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South. For the customers of these companies, it means that the government has detailed records of calls they made to family members, coworkers, business contacts, and others. One source told the paper that the NSA is attempting to create the world's largest database, big enough to include every call ever made within the nation's borders. This spy program is far more expansive than what the White House has acknowledged. Last year, President Bush admitted he'd authorized the NSA to eavesdrop without warrant on calls and emails of people suspected of having links to terrorists. On Thursday, President Bush discussed the NSA spy operations, but did not directly address the report in USA Today that the NSA is creating a database of tens of millions of phone call records.
I want to make some important points about what the government is doing and what the government is not doing. First, our intelligence activities strictly target Al-Qaeda and their known affiliates. Al-Qaeda is our enemy, and we want to know their plans. Second, the government does not listen to domestic phone calls without court approval. Third, the intelligence activities I authorized are lawful and have been briefed to appropriate members of Congress, both Republican and Democrat. Fourth, the privacy of ordinary Americans is fiercely protected in all our activities. We're not mining or trolling through the personal lives of millions of innocent Americans. Our efforts are focused on links to Al-Qaeda and their known affiliates.
That was President Bush speaking on Thursday on Capitol Hill. Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, announced he would call officials from AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South to appear before the panel for questioning. Meanwhile, there have been a number of other developments about the NSA spy program. On Wednesday, the Justice Department announced it had to close an investigation into the NSA spy program because the NSA had refused to grant investigators security clearances. On Monday, President Bush nominated General Michael Hayden to become the next director of the CIA. Hayden was the head of the NSA in 2001 when President Bush ordered the agency to begin warrantless spying of Americans. General Hayden spoke with reporters yesterday about the NSA spying program.
Everything that NSA does is lawful and very carefully done, and that the appropriate members of the Congress, House and Senate, are briefed on all NSA activities, and I think I just leave it at that.
But the NSA spy program is even being criticized by former top NSA officials. On Monday, the agency's former director, Bobby Ray Inman, said, quote, this activity is not authorized. To talk about the latest developments, we're joined on the telephone by New York Congressmember Maurice Hinchey, a Democrat. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Now, you have written a letter about the Justice Department shutting down the investigation into the NSA. What do you understand has happened? Why has it been shut down?
Well, the investigation by the Office of Professional Responsibility began earlier this year after I initiated a letter, which was signed by a number of my other colleagues in the House, asking this office within the Justice Department to look into the question of who it was in the Justice Department that approved this spying program by the NSA. Shortly after we wrote the letter, we received a reply back saying that the investigation was underway. The Office of Professional Responsibility had engaged in an investigation and they were moving forward on it. We had some other communication with the office, and which indicated that the investigation was moving ahead. We sent a letter to them asking them if they would look into specific aspects. Then the day before yesterday, we received a letter back from the counsel of the Office of Professional Responsibility saying that they were unable to make any meaningful progress in their investigation because they had been denied security clearances for access to information about the NSA program. So the administration just put a roadblock in front of them, saying that they were not going to be able to investigate any aspect of this because they were not going to be given the security clearances they need to look into the NSA. That is a shocking revelation, frankly. It is the responsibility of OPR, the Office of Professional Responsibility, to make sure that people within the Justice Department are behaving in ways that are ethical, that are within the law, and are not deviating from the protections within the Constitution. But as we've seen, this administration is not interested in that kind of activity internally, and so they have stopped that investigation. We have now written a letter back to the counsel's office asking them to inform us who it was that prevented them from continuing the investigation and what were the circumstances surrounding that prevention.
And Congressmember Henschy, who is we? Who wrote this letter?
The original letter was written by myself, was signed by John Lewis, by two or three other members of the Congress, Ms. Woolsey from California, and one or two other people.
Now, this is an issue that cuts across political lines. I mean, you have Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, is calling for an investigation. Are you finding that you have bipartisan support for the questions that you're raising?
I have seen no indication of bipartisan support within the House of Representatives. Yes, you're absolutely true. Senator Specter has raised this question, and he has indicated that the committee in which he chairs in the Senate, the Judiciary Committee, will begin some form of investigation into this practice, the spying practice. How far that investigation goes, we will see. But you're much more likely to get something that looks into this situation from the Senate than you are from the House.
And how unusual is it? Yesterday, the CIA director nominee, Michael Hayden, was supposed to do his meet and greets with various senators. And then, of course, the cameras follow, and you see him getting approval from various Republican and Democratic senators. That didn't quite happen. I think he met with Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. But other than that, even the Republican senators, these meetings were canceled.
Yes. Well, I would imagine that in the Senate there is some concern about the fact that, General Hayden was in charge of the NSA at the time when the illegal spying operation apparently began. So there is definitely going to be some interest in his background with regard to this illegal spying program, and it is an illegal spying program, and that's the main point that we have to keep focusing on here. So there will be some attention focused on him, and the question is going to be whether or not he's going to be approved. And we can anticipate that a lot of the questions surrounding his nomination are going to be focused upon this illegal spying program, why it came into existence in the first place. There is a law which was set up in 1978, which is called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act came about as a result of illegal spying which was conducted during the Nixon administration. That whole issue was examined carefully by the Congress. A lot of hearings were held. The examination was conducted. And finally, this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed in 1978, which set up a process whereby any administration that believes that some form of activity is going on in our country that is raising serious questions about security, endangering people, endangering the nation. Under circumstances such as that, any administration can engage in a surveillance program. But eventually that program must be approved through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Courts, which was set up within the Justice Department. This administration has circumvented that law, gone outside of it. One of the things that the administration has said as a result of the shutting down or the impeding, rather, of this investigation by the Office of Professional Responsibility within the Justice Department is that in the course of defending their eavesdropping program, they have said that the NSA's activities were narrowly targeted to intercept international calls and emails of Americans and others inside the United States who they suspected had ties to Al-Qaeda terror network. Well, if that were true, if that were the case, that they were narrowly targeted, then the administration would have had no trouble whatsoever securing the authority to conduct those examinations under the present Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. But as we know, they have chosen over and over again to violate that FISA law. And that has got to lead to the conclusion that their surveillance activities themselves are unlawful, and they are not in any way, as they describe them, to be narrowly targeted. And then, of course, we have the story yesterday in USA Today, which talks about tens of millions of phone calls being placed into a data bank, and the extent of the monitoring of those phone calls is unknown. The fact is that the spying operation which this administration is engaged in is illegal. It goes outside of existing law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which in fact itself was a compromise of constitutional protections. But they have now gone outside of that FISA law, and they are engaging in various forms of surveillance activities within the United States of American citizens without any jurisdiction to do so and without any action by any court, which is required by the law and, of course, by the Constitution.
New York Congressmember Marie Cinch, I want to thank you for being with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by two reporters, one who's looked at NSA involvement with other corporations outside telecom companies, and a writer for Wired magazine that has been on top of and breaking this story around the cooperation between the NSA and the telecom companies. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
I work from 9 to 5. Hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me. And I have no privacy. Oh, I always feel like somebody's watching me. Tell me, is it just a dream? When I come home at night,
Rockwell, somebody's watching me here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue on the NSA spy scandal, we're joined by two reporters who've been following this story very closely. Ryan Singel is a contributing writer at Wired News. He joins us from San Francisco, and we're joined on the telephone by investigative journalist Tim Shurock, who's covered the issue for The Nation magazine, among other places. Ryan Singel, talk about what you understand, how we came to understand the relationship between the telecom companies, particularly AT&T, and the government.
It's been kind of an ongoing story. In some ways, the USA Today report just fills out some details of what people have surmised has been going on over the last few months. Starting in December, the New York Times broke the story that the NSA was eavesdropping on international calls that came in and out of the country, where one end of the conversation was ostensibly to someone that had ties to al-Qaeda or was suspected of ties to al-Qaeda. Following that, the LA Times reported in right before Christmas that AT&T had allowed the NSA access to a massive database system of its phone calls, a database it calls Hawkeye, which, according to public information, contains something along the lines of 1.88 trillion calls, just the records of the phone calls. So then with the USA Today piece that came out yesterday, we learned that Verizon and Bell South had also given ongoing access to their phone records to the NSA, though QWest, interestingly, asked the NSA to go and get either a subpoena or a letter from the Attorney General before they would turn over the records, which the NSA declined to do.
talk about the significance of this and the Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit and what it's based on.
Sure. The significance of this is kind of fills out the picture of what the administration is likely trying to do. The call records are sensitive data, but they're not nearly as sensitive as the contents of your communication. So you're starting, you sort of see the call records as maybe the top of the funnel. So it's very unclear how they're kind of funneling down. You know, they might be starting with, say, all the phone numbers they know from people who are on the terrorist watch list. So take, you know, the 300,000 people on the terrorist watch list, take their phone numbers, see who they're calling, and look for some patterns. Then as you go through, then you might then look at the, when you see something interesting, you might then start to look at their overseas phone calls. And then from there, if you actually get something good, you might actually then, the administration might go to the FISA court, which would allow them to get not only the international phone calls, but also the contents of their domestic calls and their domestic emails and so forth. The EFF lawsuit is fairly interesting. They are building on the work of the LA Times, but they also, as they were preparing their lawsuit, a retired AT&T technician, Mark Klein, who worked for the company for 22 years, approached them, came up to their offices and says, I have some documents. And those documents remain under seal, but from what Mark Klein has said publicly, what he saw when he was working there, he saw AT&T build a secret room in its switching center in San Francisco where they took portions of the fiber optic cable that can that carry internet traffic and shunted it into a private room, a little secret room that supposedly had large data bank with some secret data mining hardware. And he said he also saw that he had also heard that this had happened in other switching locations. And ostensibly the documents that he turned over to EFF and which have been filed with the court, those are now, he wants those to be unsealed. We won't know if that's going to happen until Wednesday next week.
Could you explain exactly what Mark Klein said he saw, what this room was that was being built, who was allowed access to it within AT&T?
Sure. He said that it was a secret room on the fifth floor of a switching center here in downtown San Francisco. Fiber optic cable is not particularly easy to wiretap or eavesdrop on, as compared to the telephone network, which telephone networks have built-in wiretapping capabilities. That's something federal law requires. Fiber optic cables, it's laser shooting through a little cable. So what they've done is he saw the diagrams of how they switch things in. And it wasn't just AT&T's internet connections, according to his statement. What he said he saw was that where AT&T's internet network connected up with other networks, QS, for example, where you trade your traffic, that those links also got put into the cabinet. So it's not a huge room. You don't need quite the data bank of computers that you would need for the phone records. You know, when you're trying to keep 1.9 trillion phone records, you need a data center that's about as big as Google's. So the room is not particularly big. It wouldn't be a facility that would record. It's actually very unclear what the facility does, whether it records things there or if from there there's an uplink to the NSA where they themselves would be able to do more data mining. But that room is particularly about internet traffic. Mark Klein did not say he saw anything about phone records.
We're talking to Ryan Single, who's contributing writer to Wired News. What are the legal implications of these companies working with the government? I mean, obviously, they have a choice. As you point out, QWest, or I think a lot of people call it Quest, said no.
Thank you for correcting me there. Legal implications, it's unclear, but federal law sets limits on what phone companies can do with your records. There are very hefty fines and even criminal penalties for turning over the contents of your communications or even records of your communications if you don't, in terms of turning over the government, if you don't have a subpoena or a letter from the Attorney General saying this is an approved program. So these fines could reach millions of dollars if, in fact, they didn't get a letter or they didn't have some other sort of authorization. So they may be on shaky grounds, and that was definitely a concern of Quest. They explicitly asked the NSA, we want some legal justification, and according to the USA Today story, the NSA did not want to go through those procedures.
Ryan Singel writes for Wired News. We're also joined by Tim Shurrock, who's an independent journalist who's written about the NSA domestic surveillance program for The Nation magazine. Tim, you look back in history at the NSA's involvement with U.S. corporations. Can you talk about that?
Well, since the end of World War II, since the NSA was founded, really, they've been doing this kind of surveillance of calls by American citizens. And back in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s when they did it, it wasn't that difficult to do it because there was just a couple of companies, AT&T, IT&T, we might remember, Western Union. They went to those companies, they went to senior executives when they decided to do this, and they said, we'd like to listen to the phone calls that are going through your system. We'd like to read the cables that are going to Western Union, and that's exactly what they did. They went to high-level people in the corporation, and then that person, that top executive, would talk to someone lower down in the chain, and the NSA would do the listening, would do the surveillance. What the USA Today reported yesterday was that they're turning this awesome system they have worldwide to listen in on calls, and they're turning that whole system on to the United States. These are United States citizens within the United States they are putting into this database. This is what's really dangerous about this. And what the New York Times reported back in December was that they were listening to United States citizens talking to foreigners. Now they're building a database out of U.S. citizens talking to U.S. citizens.
Although they're saying that it's not as if they're listening to the conversations. This is just taking down the numbers.
Well, I think the whole purpose of data mining is to build profiles of people that you use for later surveillance. Like Ryan was just saying, they might build a record on someone and then go to the FISA court and tap their phone after they decide that this person is a terrorist suspect or something that they're talking to. So I take that with a grain of salt. Also, I think the record of mendacity of this Bush administration on any number of issues, particularly this war, is great. And it's very difficult to believe what they say on this. They build these databases to create profiles. They use them to predict future activities, future calls people might make, future relationships people might make. And then they use that for other kinds of information. And, of course, the U.S. government, other databases, have plenty of information on us as U.S. citizens, other buying habits. They can go to credit card records, see what you buy, all this kind of thing. And so they can plug all this in, build profiles, and that's I think that's what's got Republicans and of course Democrats, people of all stripes, upset about this. Is that this is a violation of FISA? It's a violation of our privacy laws, and it's a violation of the Constitution.
And the history, Tim Shurrock, of other U.S. corporations.
Well, I think we've seen. Like I said, there was primarily just, when this was first done, the telecom system wasn't like it is today. And so now we have an explosion of telecom companies like AT&T, a whole number of companies, including companies like Singular Wireless that provide wireless services. Then we have these fiber optic cables companies that operate cables that go under the sea, which was just, explained a few minutes ago, are much more difficult to tap. That's where you need the cooperation of these companies.
And the connection between the executives of these companies and the military in this country?
Well, the thing is that for the last 10 years or so, there's been quite a close relationship growing between telecom industry people and the government. As I reported in my Nation piece, there's a kind of murky organization called the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee, which meets twice a year with people at the White House. The last meeting, Dick Cheney was at their meeting, where they discuss, issues of national security. security involved in the telecom system. I went on their website. Anybody can go on to it. It's ncs.gov, and you can go to the president's committee part of the thing, and you can see who's on this committee. And coincidentally, right now the chair happens to be Mr. Dwayne Ackerman, the president, chairman, and CEO of Bell South, which was the company named in the USA Today report yesterday. And so you have executives from all these telecom companies are on this, as well as other high-tech companies that are involved in telecom. They, of course, the committee says they don't discuss surveillance or these kinds of issues, but, you know, they do meet and they talk about national security.
And you write, Sprint Nextel is top-loaded with executives with long experience in national security and defense. Chairman and CEO Gary Forsey is a member of Bush's Telecom Council, as is Lawrence Babbio, the vice chair and president of Verizon.
Right. And when I was working on the story, I went back into, you know, various testimony that some of these companies have given, and they, you know, they all contract with the intelligence community to do various kinds of work. And, you know, they brag about it in their testimony. They say, you know, we have a long record of cooperation with intelligence and so on. So these relationships go back many, many years. And I think what we have now is you know, a group of people that meet, you know, and they all have security clearances to do this. So, you know, it so happens that Quest also has a seat on this board. So maybe they're meeting actually this week, I believe, in Washington. They probably have some interesting conversations. As I pointed out in my article in The Nation, there's also a lot of other contractors outside of telecom that we should be concerned about. These are the companies that actually do the data mining, that provide the software and technology that the NSA uses for their surveillance programs and for their analytical programs. And I think, you know, it's important for people to remember that the NSA is just an awesome organization in terms of the power it has. People might remember Colin Powell's, infamous testimony to the UN when he played intercepts that the U.S. had picked up of Iraqis, you know, talking about so-called weapons of mass destruction. Well, when that Bob Woodward talked about that incident, and when people at the NSA were watching Colin Powell's live testimony and those intercepts came on, they all applauded because their work was being recognized. Well, that's pretty awesome. You can pick up a tiny bit of conversation and figure out the words that you're going to use out of thousands and thousands and thousands of words that are out there. That's how powerful this software is. And now they're using this to listen in on conversations to monitor our calls, and that's what's dangerous.
Tim Shurok, I want to thank you for being with us, independent journalist who's written extensively about NSA domestic surveillance. He has written for The Nation magazine, and Ryan Single, contributing writer to Wired News. Thank you both very much for joining us. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk to a yes man, a corporate impersonator, and then to a mother who lost her son in Iraq as we move into this Mother's Day. She'll join us from Washington, where women are gathering from around the country in a Mother's Day protest outside the White House. Stay with us.
Me llaman el desaparecido. Cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy. Deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido. Cuando me buscan nunca estoy. Cuando me encuentran yo no soy el que está enfrente, porque ya me fui corriendo más allá. Me dicen el desaparecido, fantasma que nunca está. Me dicen el desagradecido, pero esa no es la verdad. Yo llevo en el cuerpo un dolor que no me deja respirar. Llevo en el cuerpo una condena que siempre me echa a caminar. Me dicen el desaparecido, que cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy, deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido.
Manu Chao, Desaparecido, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the yes men have struck again. On Tuesday, a man claiming to be a representative of Halliburton gave a presentation at the Catastrophic Loss Conference at the Ritz-Carlton, Amelia Island, Florida. The conference included leaders from the insurance industry. The phony spokesperson gave his name as Fred Wolf and began by warning conference-goers of the dangers of climate change.
So first of all, let's define our words. What do we mean when we say safety? For us in the corporate world, it's quite simple. We mean the safety to achieve what we need, how we need it, and when we need it. Insurance firms are also concerned with a special case definition of safety, which is the safety of people. Because their own safety depends so much on this special case definition of safety, insurance has become extremely worried about some grave new dangers to people that we're seeing in the world around us today. And I'm, of course, talking about climate change and the disasters that it brings. To make things worse, there are some who believe that this is only the start, and that the sort of experiences we've seen here are just the minor beginning to what could happen. For example, Arctic melt has slowed the Gulf Stream by about 30% in the last decade. If it stopped, Europe would become just as cold as Alaska. It could go the other way. Methane released from melting permafrost could cause a heating cycle, a feedback loop, as we call it, making human life essentially unlivable outside air-conditioned hotels like this one. But panicking is not the answer either, of course. If we panic and try to stop climate change, 70% of our carbon emissions have to come to a stop immediately, which would be a rather huge blow to our way of doing business. But I can personally guarantee you that level heads will always be able to turn lemons into lemonade. Consider the Black Plague. This was an unspeakably rotten event, of course, in which one-third of Europe's population died in great agony. And no one, of course, would wish such a thing on any civilization. Yet without it, without the Black Plague, the old business models of Europe would never have been overturned by the entrepreneurs of the Renaissance. And what would the world be without the Mona Lisa? Or closer to home, how about the Great Deluge? This world-ending disaster, literally, was surely seen as a terrible catastrophe by Noah's contemporaries and perhaps by Noah himself. Yet Noah was ready to seize the day, and at the end of that day, not only was there a whole new world, but Noah found himself with a monopoly of the animals. Innovations like these could turn some major disasters into as humdrum a fact of life as glaucoma, meningitis, or gallstones are to the medical insurance industry today. For those of us in positions of responsibility, however, who might have to take charge in a crisis, even more innovative solutions are necessary. We can't be satisfied with survival. We have to guarantee at every instant the capacity and resources to keep our thumbs firmly on the triggers of progress.
Fred Wolf, or so he said he was, well, one of the yes-men posing as a corporate spokesperson for Halliburton at a LexisNexis conference called Catastrophic Loss at the Ritz-Carlton in Amelia Island, Florida. The corporate impersonators went on to tell the conference-goers that Halliburton had come up with a new invention, the survivable, an orb-like inflatable suit that would keep corporate managers safe from global warming. Well, Fred Wolf suited up into the survivable, his fellow yes man Mike Bonanno introduced the new technology.
A few years ago, we were asked to take on a big challenge. In the R&D department at Halliburton, we're usually dealing with oil rigs, things like that, drilling, questions of energy extraction. And they gave us a big challenge. In 2001, they said, we want something that's going to be able to save a human being no matter what Mother Nature throws at them. And so this is the answer. This is the Halliburton Survivaball. As some of you probably know, amoebas can gather together. These are designed like amoebas, as single cells. But they can gather together and actually form another body. They aggregate and they differentiate function. And so these one-celled organisms come together as a single body.
Yes, man, Mike Bonanno, introducing the survivaballs to corporate executives at the Catastrophic Loss Conference in Florida Tuesday. The suits look like large plastic bubbles with six hands, two speakerphone-looking ears, and an opening for the executive's face. The Yes Men hoax comes less than 2 years after a Yes Men member appeared on the BBC claiming to be a spokesperson for Dow Chemical. He said Dow was taking responsibility for the Bhopal chemical disaster, forcing the company to remind the world it did not take responsibility responsibility for the disaster and that there was no compensation fund set up for the victims. Well, we're joined now by one of the Yes Men. Yes, Andy Picklebaum, or so he tells us his name is. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks a lot.
So you explain what happened here. This is a formal conference, insurance executives on Amelia Island in Florida. Mm-hmm. LexisNexis is the sign under the podium. Mm-hmm. How were you invited as a spokesperson for Halliburton?
Same way we've been invited to a lot of these things. You know, we set up a fake website, and one thing led to another.
What was the website?
HalliburtonContracts.com. And you can see our full release about the survivable on that site now. At the time, it looked it didn't have anything about the survivable on the front. They just, you know, it looked like a Halliburton site, and one thing led to another.
They emailed you, and there you were as a spokesperson. And then you suited up in this mass ball.
Yeah, I had one ball on. It would protect me under any climate change conditions, you know, any natural disaster arising from our misuse of the environment. I, as a corporate manager, would be safe in this thing. And two of the other people at the conference, actually the moderator and the other panelist, also suited up. And there we were.
A gated community of one, each of these balls.
Each, yeah. Three gated communities, each of one. Yeah.
When did the insurance executives start catching on?
Well, never. Yeah. One of them kind of got it, I think. One of the people in the audience and found it very funny and, you know, said he basically couldn't believe it. He happened to be the next speaker and said to Mike, I just can't believe I have to follow that. And that was hysterical. Do you guys make a living at this? He clearly got it, but nobody else did. There were three questions afterwards, and I have to say I was flabbergasted to hear the first one. It was, this is great, but what about terrorism? I mean, this must be useful against terrorism. And we had to explain that, well, you know, it's mainly, it's got a bit of defensive capability, some elementary RPGs, and maybe some other, you know, torpedo launchers. But basically, inside the survivor ball. But mainly that's for use against affluent members of the community who are trying to destroy your, of the neighboring community, because those are the only people who can afford at that point to travel. Terrorism from the Middle East or whatever, we're just not, that's off the out of the picture at this point.
For our radio listeners, I just want to let you know what the ball looks like. You become an inflatable ball.
Yeah, a giant, I guess about 6 feet diameter ball with a face right in the middle of it.
Now, Andy Picklebaumer, so you say you are, this comes 2 years after your event. Is it 2 years or 1 year after the Dow Chemical imposing as a Dow Chemical spokesperson on the anniversary of the Bhopal disaster and actually being interviewed by BBC because they emailed you on a Dow Chemical website, or so they thought it was.
Right. They were looking for a spokesperson for Dow to issue a statement on the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal catastrophe, and they emailed us instead at dowethics.com instead of dow.com.
Were you Jude Finisterra?
Yeah, I was Jude Finisterra.
And how'd you choose that name?
Jude is the patron saint of the impossible, and Finisterra is end of the earth, etymologically. So it's just an absolutely impossible thing, what we did, which was basically accept responsibility for the disaster as Dow. And Dow will never accept responsibility for the disaster. And that's provable by what happened afterwards. After the announcement, when I accepted responsibility for the disaster on behalf of Dow, Dow's stock price plunged by about $3 billion in 20 minutes, which isn't good for Dow, of course, and that's why they don't do the right thing, obviously.
So has anything developed since then with Dow, as they had to say, no, we didn't accept responsibility? And has Halliburton responded to what you did in Florida?
Dow never did respond, except for their usual one-liner about not having responsibility. We actually issued a press release on their behalf to fully explain what they weren't going to do, explaining that our thing was a hoax. Sent out a press release from Dow explaining that ours was a hoax and outlining exactly what we wouldn't do as Dow. We would not clean up the site. We would not compensate these people. They would continue to die, etc. Halliburton hasn't responded either, so we may be forced to do the same thing. And yeah, these companies, I think, just prefer not to respond, because if they do, they know that it's pretty good for us.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Andy Bicklebaum, member of The Yes Men. And your website is?
TheYesMen.org.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
As we end today's program with Mother's Day. Yes, Sunday is Mother's Day, and a group of women have chosen to honor it by calling for peace. Women from all over the country gathering in Washington this weekend will be holding an all-night vigil outside the White House to demand the troops be brought home now. The main organizer of the weekend's event is the group Code Pink. This is what they've written about why they are taking action. They write, "We, the women of the United States, Iraq, and women worldwide, have had enough of the senseless war in Iraq and the cruel attacks on civilians around the world. We've buried too many of our loved ones. We've seen too many lives crippled forever by physical and mental wounds. We've watched in horror as our precious resources are poured into war while our families' basic needs of food, shelter, education, health care go unmet. This is not the world we want for ourselves or our children. With fire in our bellies and love in our hearts, we women are rising up across borders to unite and demand an end to the bloodshed and the destruction," they write. We're joined in Washington studio by Elaine Johnson. Her son, Specialist Darius Jennings, was killed November 2003 when the Chinook helicopter was shot down in Iraq. Darius was 22 when he died. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about your son and why you'll be in Washington outside the White House this Mother's Day?
First of all, I'd like to say good morning, and thank you for having me on your show. My son was Specialist Darius Jennings, and he was a mama's boy. And Mother's Day is Sunday, and every mother that lost a son would love for the son to walk in the door on Mother's Day and say, "Happy Mother's Day," with a bunch of flowers. That will never happen to me and a lot more mothers anymore since our sons and daughters were killed over in Iraq.
In South Carolina, in the unit your son was in, how many of the soldiers have died in Iraq or been wounded?
Okay, my son was stationed at Fort Carson in Colorado Springs, but from my hometown of South Carolina, we have lost 39 soldiers.
39. And what is the feeling in the community? Do other mothers and fathers, the community, share your feelings? Do they want the soldiers to come home now? Or do they support the war? Or are they opposed to it?
They're opposed to the war. They want the soldiers to come home now. And when they come home, for the government to take care of the soldiers when they bring them back home.
We're also joined on the telephone by Cindy Sheehan. Her son, Casey, was killed in Iraq April 4, 2004, in Sadr City. She, too, is headed to Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Cindy.
Oh, good morning, Amy. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning, Cindy.
I can't wait to see you.
Me too.
Cindy, can you talk about this Mother's Day and what it means to you and what your plans are? You're now in Seattle.
Right. Well, as soon as I get off the phone, I'm heading to the airport to get to Washington, D.C. to stand with Elaine and other mothers, Susan Sarandon, Randy Rhodes and Willie Nelson's wife, and we're going to stand other people, you know, other good mothers with good hearts, and we're going to stand together to say enough is enough. Like Elaine said, too many of our sons and daughters are being killed for George Bush and his lies and his war for corporate greed. And what this Mother's Day means to me, like it means to Elaine, is the same thing every day means to me. My son was killed needlessly and senselessly. I will not get, he used to send me funny cards on Mother's Day. I used to get phone calls from him every day, but, you know, Mother's Day especially. And that is something that will be missing in my life for the rest of my life because of George Bush and the neocons. And, you know, it's heartbreaking, but what Elaine and I want to do is stop this from happening to other mothers before it's too late for them.
Elaine Johnson, what is the response of other military families to you, to your call for the troops to come home now?
I have their full support of bringing the troops home. Every time I do different rallies and different events, I get emails and phone calls, you know, telling me to keep up the good work, because we all support our troops. We just don't support this war, because when I met President Bush back in 2003, there was nothing he couldn't tell me, why my son was killed, why the soldiers are over there. And here it is 2006, and the matter has not gotten better. It's just gotten worse. So he still can't tell me anything why our kids are getting killed. But, you know, we know why. It's because of the awe. Like Cindy was saying, the greediness of him and his colleagues is for oil.
Cindy Sheehan, you, Code Pink, women's organizations have taken out letters in Iraqi papers, Iraqi women, U.S. women, mothers, calling for the occupation to end. Some newspapers are publishing them. Others aren't in Iraq. Can you talk about this?
Well, you know, here we're supposed to be spreading freedom and democracy to Iraq, and we know every day our own freedoms are being eroded in the United States. Our corporate media is not free. They're getting our phone records of just normal Americans. And here we're spreading freedom and democracy to Iraq, and their press isn't free there either. And many of the so-called free press in Iraq won't print our letters. So we have to put pressure on the people to actually have a free press in America, and you know very well that we don't. They don't have it in Iraq either. And also in D.C., this Mother's Day, we're calling for an end of the occupation, but also for an end to this evil rhetoric of them talking about invading Iran. And people can go to don'tattackiran.org, too. But there's so much. We have to get out in the streets. We have to get out like the immigrants, because we as America have to realize that we are intimately connected to and are being harmed by George Bush's policies in the Middle East. So I want everybody just to go to codepinkalert.org. We have petitions. We have ways you can sign up to support us. And we all have to stand up and do this. You know, over 70% of America now do not support George Bush and what's going on. And we have to translate that into policy.
Elaine Johnson, why did your son join the military?
My son joined the military because he wanted stability. He was a mama's boy, and the military did provide the stability. And it was for money for college. I come from a small town in South Carolina where there are no jobs and no money for schools. So my son joined the military, you know, because of financial reasons, you know, going to college. And no jobs. And I'm here also a member of the Military Family Speak Out, Gold Star Family Speak Out, Black Voices for Peace. And we are now starting an organization called Military Moms Speak Out. Damu Smith, who is deceased now, was the founder of Military Moms Speak Out. So that's like other people in South Carolina. You know, I come from a town that's lost 4 soldiers due to them joining the military because of financial reasons, money for college. They didn't join to go fight a war for no reason. You know, and this war was for no reason based on the American people. Now, for the president, his reason was for oil. For Donald Rumsfeld, his reason was for oil. Ms. Rice, she's backing the president, I guess, because that's her job. But what about the military families that's suffering? We are suffering. We are suffering mentally. We are suffering physically.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Elaine Johnson and Cindy Sheehan both will be in front of the White House on Sunday, on Mother's Day. And we will cover that and bring it to our listeners and viewers on Monday here on Democracy Now! That does it for the broadcast. For a copy of the show, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yuba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineer. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin and Megan Whitney. Again, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.